The delay, we've been having caucuses, and they tend to delay us a little bit. So we got a room full of people and a full agenda today. So we are going to start with opening a work session on SJR 18.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill SJR 18 comes from Senator Przanski, and the bill amends Articles 10, Section 15 of the Constitution as it relates to forfeitures. You have the dash 3 amendments in front of you, and you may remember our discussion last week. We went through the amendments, and the one thing I want to point out that's in this amendment, except for forfeitures of animals, this section does not apply to the forfeiture animals that have been abused, neglected, or abandoned. There was discussion last week on that. Dash 3 amendments before you. They supersede the 1 and the 2s.
Thank you. Senator Przanski, do you have anything you wish to add to this?
I think we've already covered everything, Madam Chair, regarding our last hearing where we acknowledged all the individuals that put work into this. And based on council's review, it looks like we just need to move the bill forward, understanding that there's still a couple of component bills, companion bills that need to move forward for the ballot title, et cetera, which we will be working on in ASAP.
That's correct. So any other comments from the committee?
Oh, I saw the great bunny caper issue on the news last night.
Okay.
I thought that was pretty cool.
That's pretty good. Okay. Senator Przanski, we have the dash 3 amendments in front of us.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash 3 amendments into SJR 18.
Senator Przanski has moved the dash 3 amendments into SJR 18. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Przanski?
Madam Chair, I move SJR 18 as amended by the dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski has moved SJR 18 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Przanski, would you carry it? And again, I want to thank everyone who worked on this bill. This was a long time in the making, at least 2 years, and look forward to getting it across the floors and to the voters. Okay, so now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1014. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 1014 relates to existing ORS 137.707. Under that law, if a 15, 16, or 17-year-old defendant is charged with any one of approximately 22 specific offenses, each one of which has a specific presumptive sentence starting at least 70 months in prison, the defendant must be prosecuted as an adult in criminal court as opposed to juvenile court. Juvenile courts have different rules than criminal court relating to matters such as the court's authority to sentence or the length of probation and jail sanctions. Senate Bill 1014 amends the requirement regarding adult criminal court jurisdiction being automatic. Specifically, what it says is that when a 15, 16, or 17-year-old defendant is charged with any one of the 22 specific offenses, then the criminal court, not the juvenile court, shall hold a hearing to determine if the proceeding should be continued in juvenile court. The defendant has the burden by a preponderance of the evidence to prove either, one, that at the time of the offense, the defendant was, quote, not of sufficient sophistication and maturity to appreciate the quality of the conduct involved, close quote, or two, that retaining jurisdiction in criminal court does not serve the best interests of the person or of society. Senate Bill 1014 requires the criminal court to consider factors listed at ORS 419C.349 sub 4 in making its jurisdictional determination. Such factors include, but are not limited to, the defendant's amenability to treatment, community protection, the nature of the alleged offense, the youth's previous history, the gravity of the loss or injury, the prosecutive merit of the case, and the desirability of disposing of the case in one trial if there are any adult co-defendants.
Okay. We have a lot of people signed up to testify, so what we will do is we will start out with a panel of three on both sides, and then we will alternate so that both sides get an equal chance to present their arguments. So we will start out with David Rogers, Judge Kosh, and Dr. Barry Kinsberg.
Can I ask a question of counsel?
Please, Senator Walker.
In my bill file is a copy of this bill, and it says corrected title. And I've been looking at the title, and I can't figure out what the problem is.
The corrected title, I can actually answer that to my chagrin, is this requires a two-thirds vote, and the original bill did not. Is that correct, Council?
That's correct, Chair Burke.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Burdick, members of the committee. My name is David Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice, a statewide advocacy organization that works to strengthen the public safety system to make it more effective and also more just. I'm here to strongly support Senate Bill 1014. I think that this bill makes profound sense. The bill is actually based on the premise that we need a different approach for justice and accountability when we're talking about juveniles. Adolescents are still developing and most, in fact, age out of criminal behavior, particularly when given access to intervention and rehabilitation programs. And, you know, we need to think very carefully before we abandon the future of young people by giving them very long adult sentences. In fact, what you'll hear from many of the people who are testifying is that we have learned a tremendous amount about adolescent development and behavior in relationship to crime and violence. And, you know, we need to be able to take what it is we've learned in the past 12 years since the passage of Measure 11 into consideration. We also need to recognize that juveniles, in fact, are not adults. In fact, many laws around the country acknowledge that by preventing juveniles from marrying without parental consent, from sitting on juries, and also from voting. So we need a different approach to justice. What you also hear from people is that juvenile courts work, and so we need to actually strengthen the ability for them to do their job. You'll also hear from folks is that there's a tremendous amount of research around the country that shows that Senate Bill 1014 is, in fact, the best approach to public safety. It's the best approach because the research shows that youth treated as adults recidivate more often than youth treated in juvenile court. And so from a public safety perspective, it is to our advantage to have a thoughtful approach and make sure that youth who actually would be better served in juvenile court, in fact, are served in juvenile court because it means that they're less likely to commit future crime. Also, what you'll hear later is that there's strong public support for this type of change. And, you know, it's worth acknowledging that some of the opposition to this bill, really, they're stuck in the past in the recognition that, yes, Measure 11 was passed 12 years ago with significant support. I should also say that 12 years is, in fact, a very long time, and public opinion has very much changed. In fact, if I had a dime for every single time I heard, if I knew then what I knew now about Measure 11, I never would have voted for it. But it's important to say that this Senate Bill 1014 is also a very modest change to Measure 11. It's not a dramatic overhaul. This is really particularly focused on the way young people are impacted. And it ensures that we have a thoughtful approach, making sure that before we make that decision to treat any young person, any juvenile, as an adult in the criminal justice system, and, you know, potentially throw away their lives and their future, and perhaps also make them more likely to commit future crime in the process, we're going to create a transparent and thoughtful process to make sure that that's the right decision. And really, that's what this is about. You know, there will be several district attorneys here that, you know, are opposing this bill. And right now, they're the ones who actually make the decision about whether or not a young person is treated as an adult or not. And really, this is not about actually putting DAs on trial. You know, they may say that judges oftentimes will make mistakes in terms of that decision. You know, it would be foolish for us to think that DAs are not and prosecutors are not capable of making mistakes as well. Really, this is about acknowledging how is the decision made. And ultimately, what we need is a thoughtful, transparent process that, obviously, prosecutors are involved in that process. A lot of people, we need more people involved in to come together to really figure out before we actually treat that young person as an adult, is that the best decision? And to pull as much information together as possible. Mm-hmm. And that decision should be made by judges who are trained professionals and who are, in fact, the unbiased actors in our criminal justice process. It's also worth noting that the decision to treat a young person as an adult is very serious because, you know, once you treat a juvenile as an adult and they're convicted, they'll never get rid of that adult felony conviction. And so when they do get out, and over 95% of everyone in prison does return to the community, you know, they have those barriers, access to employment, access to housing, that they'll need to deal with. I want to share a couple of last things, which is that, I hope that one thing you shouldn't do is oppose this in the name of crime victims, because there's clearly no consensus there. I expect that you'll probably hear from crime victims who oppose this. I know that you'll hear from crime survivors who support this, that think that this is a step in the right direction, that shifts our system in a focus on prevention and takes a more thoughtful approach to treating juveniles, and to make sure that we're not actually letting them slip through the cracks, those that would much more benefit from the juvenile justice system. Actually, that's all I'll say. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Crisberg, I'm sorry I got your name wrong when I introduced you.
Okay. I'm Barry Crisberg. I'm the president of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, which this year is celebrating its 100th anniversary. We're the nation's oldest criminal justice research organization. We have long-standing ties to the state of Oregon for many, many years. Senator Mark Hatfield was a valued and important member of our board of directors. And if you may indulge me, I also have a connection because my son studied at the University of Oregon and was a star on the rugby team, and so I spent a fair amount of time in this neck of the woods. I want to address essentially three issues, the first issue being the public safety question. There's been a fair amount of research on this issue of whether or not trying kids as adults, placing them in the adult system, deters crime, impacts public safety. The studies go back to Ohio studies in the mid-80s. There have been studies in Florida, Minnesota, Arizona, Utah, and New York, New Jersey. And every one of them has found that comparable cases, when they're handled in the adult system, have higher recidivism rates when they come out of prison, as most of these folks will. To me, the most telling study is a study done by Professor Jeffrey Fagan at Columbia University, where he compared virtually identical youth in those two states. New York has a very low age of jurisdiction. New Jersey has a higher age of 18. And what he found when he basically matched cases up for many, many years, he found that across the board, youth in New York State had much higher recidivism rates and further crime patterns than, again, same youth handled by the juvenile system in the state of New Jersey. Again, there's a number of studies, and the federal data coming from the National Correctional Reporting Program, again, consistently reports that to the extent that you can draw comparisons, the decision to place a youth in an adult system is going to produce higher rates of offending when the youth comes out. So the public safety issue, I would say, is largely settled. I know of no study ever been done that's demonstrated the counter to that. The other thing is I want to pick up what David said. 12 years is a long time ago. In this country in 1994 and in this state, we were in the midst of a juvenile crime wave. Juvenile violence was at its peak. There was great concern about a generation of super predators. There was a tremendous fear that led a number of places to begin looking at reevaluating whether or not the juvenile court should even exist. Public opinion has shifted dramatically after 12 years, and I will share with you a national public opinion poll which we commissioned in January of this year using Zogby International Polling Group. It's a telephone poll of 1,000 likely voters. And what this poll found was, while citizens continue to feel that juvenile crime is an important problem, by 15-1, the U.S. voting public thinks that decisions to transfer youth to the adult system should be done on a case-by-case basis. By a 9-1 ratio, they believe that this decision should be made by a judge. The least popular decision is to allow a prosecutor to make this decision. Two-thirds of the public does not believe that incarcerating youth in adult facilities deters them from committing crime. In fact, about the same number thinks that it makes youth worse. So on virtually every measure we asked, the public rejects this kind of policy. So whatever motivated and whatever drove voters in this state to consider this 12 years ago, this is not where the public is at today. And while public policy shouldn't slavishly follow public opinion, obviously, as representatives of the people, you should be interested in what their views are and what they have to say. The last thing I want to mention is this is a very important year. It's the 40th anniversary of the In re Galt decision, the Supreme Court decision that transformed juvenile justice in this country and established the fundamental foundations of what we now think of as juvenile justice. One of the key issues in Galt, but even before Galt in the Kent case, was the matter of transfer or waiver of juveniles to the adult system. And the Supreme Court in Kent came down on the side of a transparent public forum. They wanted transcripts. They wanted attorneys. They wanted witnesses that could be confronted. They wanted evidence presented in the full light of day, which is not the same as a back office in a district attorney's office. And so I think it is good public policy. I think there are youth who need to be put in adult facilities. This is not an argument for this being absolutely a bad thing to do, but if we're going to make that decision, we need to make that decision in a proper way, relying upon skilled individuals and a process which is open and fair to everybody. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just a question on the studies that you referenced. Were any of those studies restricted specifically to the crimes referenced in this bill?
Oh, yeah.
So
some of them.
Specifically to this list of crimes.
Well, there has never been a specific study of Oregon's, this kind of study in Oregon. But in many of these jurisdictions, Utah, for example, Minnesota, it's been limited to basically person crimes of this type.
But the point that you made was that it was apples and apples. It was comparison of the same crime in the two different venues.
To the extent we could. I mean, this is a tough issue because you're not going to randomly assign people to different systems. But, I would say a lot of highly respected researchers trying the best they could pretty much came up with the same finding. And, again, I can't point – I mean, I'd love to find one, but I can't point to a single study that's ever argued that the rates of recidivism are equal or lower by putting youth in the adult system. And if, you can indulge me, one of the things we found is the research suggests that when you put young persons in prison systems, they tend to stay longer, also because they get into lots of disciplinary problems. They spend a lot of time in lockup. The surveys suggest that they're much less likely to receive mental health or other treatment services. So you're starting out with probably deeply troubled young people, and then you put them into a system that's less likely than the juvenile system to respond to mental health and other needs. And so when they come out worse.
How do you respond to the argument that, these are often very damaging, terrible crimes that are committed, and that if nothing else, at least it keeps them off the streets for a longer period of time?
Well, again, I don't have any argument with that general that principle. I just think that the value of this legislation is it allows the court to review again some years later whether or not that initial decision really is applicable. I mean, given that the nature of adolescence are that they change. And
well,
they changed pretty dramatically.
This particular bill is at the front end. This is the one where the judge gets to decide at the front end whether to put them into adult court or juvenile court.
Well, again, my argument is not against the general principle that some youth need long sentences. The question is, what's the process that we decide that? And I think an open adversarial process overseen by a judge makes much more sense to me. The keep them off the streets argument, again, if what you're buying is higher and more violent crimes on the back end when they come out, since almost all of these youth will come out, you know, you just postponed for a while the inevitability and maybe made it worse.
Thank you. Question, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like the clarification on the study. You seem to be talking about studies that show juveniles put into adult prisons come out more violent, yet juveniles in Oregon, even if they're sentenced in an adult court, don't go into adult prisons. They go into youth facilities until at least the age of 25, I believe, at which time, if they're still in the correction system, then they get transferred to an adult court. So are your studies talking about where they are sentenced, the venue they are sentenced in, or where they have been put for incarceration?
Most of the studies have to do with the venue of incarceration. But in the California system, for example, where we have a similar situation where we keep youth up to age 25 in our juvenile system, the answer is, yeah, they will do better. But then my question to you is, if you're going to keep them in the juvenile system up to age, let's say, 25 or whatever age, 21 you decide, why then not at that age review the circumstances before automatically continuing that term? What then is the purpose?
That's not as the subject of this bill.
Can I add something?
Mr. Rudd, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Beyer, some of the juveniles actually who are charged with Measure 11 crimes will in fact do adult time. And so although juveniles who can stay in the Oregon Youth Authority system up until the age of 25, that doesn't mean that they're not going to do time in the Department of Correction institutions. It really depends on the length of their sentence. And actually many Measure 11 sentences in fact would absolutely have them doing time in adult prison. And so in that respect, actually, for bringing it back around to public safety, that is an issue, because if we acknowledge that, in fact, youth and adolescents can change, particularly when given access to the types of rehabilitation programs that are definitely in the Oregon Youth Authority institutions and not in our adult prisons, much of that transformation we're going to see dissipate once that they find themselves transferred into an adult prison. And that's one of the things that potentially can be avoided for some of the young people where, given this process, the decision is made actually to treat them as juveniles. Obviously, that decision isn't going to be made every single time. It's going to be a thoughtful process, and for many young people, it'll probably be deemed appropriate to continue to treat them as adults. But we'll have a thoughtful process making that decision.
Clarification from counsel: if this bill was to pass as written, and maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but would it mean then that if the judge determines that juvenile should be tried in juvenile court, then they would no longer be subject to Measure 11 sentencing?
Senator Beyer, that would be my understanding. That it would be, because there's a provision in the bill that suggests, I believe if you look at page 1, lines 15 through 17, if the court makes either of the findings described in subsection 2 of this section, the court shall enter an order remanding the person to juvenile court for proceedings consistent with ORS Chapter 419C. And my understanding is that ORS Chapter 419C governs the juvenile's sentencing authority. So that would govern and not the Measure 11 presumptive sentences.
Okay. Thank you very much. Judge Kosh.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to be here today. I'm Dale Kosh, and I'm a judge in Portland, Oregon. And I'm here not as representative of the Oregon Judicial Department, but as an individual judge, and also in my capacity as president of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, which is an organization of approximately 1,800 judges and other professionals around the country who are interested in juvenile justice and other family law issues. I began my, before I came on the bench, I actually began my career as a prosecutor, as many of us on the bench did, and have now been on the bench for a little more than 14 years. And I appreciate the opportunity to really add a judge's perspective to this discussion. I also want to make it clear that I'm not here really, although the supporters of the bill asked me to come and testify, I'm not here to say I'm supporting this particular legislation, but rather just to try to add the judge's perspective to the discussion. The juvenile courts, that whole process started over 100 years ago. The first juvenile court was formed in Chicago in 1899, and we were one of the first states to follow that process and adopted the juvenile court in Multnomah County in 1905. We celebrated our 100-year anniversary 2 years ago there. The key difference and the key focus when juvenile courts were formed was to focus in on the individual and to recognize that the best way to deal with juveniles, with young people, was by individual justice, individualized justice, as opposed to a more blanket approach to each individual, to a larger group. And the idea being that this approach would really provide the optimal community safety because the juvenile court would be looking at imposing consequences that have the best chance of providing positive change for that youth. In other words, creating a situation where that youth was least likely to come back before a court or least likely to victimize somebody in the future. And as was discussed, juvenile courts have evolved through that 100 years, and in the 1990s, there was a move not only in this state, but in really across the country to move away from the individualized justice approach and move towards really one that was more a punitive approach towards juveniles who were committing offenses. And Measure 11 was really just a response to that, a response to some situations in this state that created anecdotal information that the judges in some cases weren't appropriately responding to those juvenile issues. The one thing that's happened is was pointed out by Barry when he was testifying is that we've now had a number of years with these more punitive laws in place, and we've had an opportunity to examine the consequences of that. In 2005, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention asked the National Council to put together juvenile delinquency guidelines. In other words, some guidelines to use to form model approaches towards dealing with juvenile justice issues, and put together a work group that included prosecutors, probation officers, the federal government, judges, and others who were researchers in the juvenile justice area to kind of look at what the best approaches were, look at the research that was out there in terms of taking the best approaches. And the basic tenets of those guidelines are that we need to hold youth accountable for their illegal behavior. That's absolutely essential. We need to deliver clear consequences for illegal acts, and we need to teach youth necessary behavior change. We need to look at the severity of the offense and look at the needs and strengths of the youth in determining what's the appropriate intervention. The guidelines also very strongly affirm the policy that waiver decisions should be made on a case-by-case basis, and that we need to not only look at the conduct involved, and that is a very key component of what we're looking at in terms of the making decisions about waiver, but we also need to take a look at the youth and the other relevant facts and circumstances that might exist. And we realize that's a very weighty decision for a judge to make, but the guidelines advocate and the National Council and our research arm, which is the National Center for Juvenile Justice in Pittsburgh, very strongly support that having an open process that everyone can present the relevant evidence and then have a decision made in a judicial context in an open courtroom about whether waiver is appropriate, or in this case, I think as this bill is talking about, reverse waiver is appropriate, is the best practice and one that we should be seriously looking at. I realize the emotional background that we have this discussion in, but I do very much appreciate that this committee and House Committee on another bill are actually having a serious look at this and hearing discussion from both sides and trying to take a look at what is the best evidence and what would be the best approach for dealing with juvenile offenders who are involved in very serious juvenile criminal behavior. Thank you.
Thank you for coming, Judge Kosh. Any questions from the committee? Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the testimony of all of you here. Judge, I just want to tell you I really appreciated the historical perspective about juvenile court and how it started. I just found it fascinating, and the emphasis on individualized justice, and I don't think we get that in adult court. So, you know, I'm sorry to tell you that, but because the thing that I think we fail to realize in many cases, not every child is a beaver cleaver. We all know that. There are some children who you can't imagine that they would do heinous things like they do, but they still are children. And they're still growing, they're still maturing, and there is an issue, I think, here that needs to be discussed, and it flies in the face of this individualized justice program that you talked about, which is how this all started in this country. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree with that. And one of the, I was involved in doing waiver hearings back at the time that they still existed, and it was interesting. One of the issues, and some of the people in this courtroom were. In this hearing room today were prosecutors in cases in front of me, and some were defense attorneys in cases in front of me. And one of the interesting issues that existed back then and we need to continue to think about in the future was that there were resources that we were able to devote to youth if we kept them in the juvenile system that if they got waived into the adult system weren't available for mm-hmm. them. And that was a very unfortunate situation and created a difficult decision in terms of where they would be, which system that they would be prosecuted under. And in regard to your point about them being children, I heard a judge from New York who handles, his sole docket is handling cases for kids 14 through 17 who are charged with these serious crimes, talking about the fact that I don't think that any of us would like to be forever defined by who we were and what we did when we were 15 years old, but that is in essence what happens to youth today for a number of different reasons, and I'm not here to say that there aren't some youth who should not be defined in that way, and that there aren't youth at that age who we would all believe we would best never be coming back into the public sphere because they would be too dangerous to do so, but we should be making that decision on an individual by individual basis as opposed to blanket basis.
Thank you. I agree, and I believe that as a judge you're quite capable of making that decision rather than the system that we have now, but that's my opinion.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Doug Harkelrod, Walt Beglow, and Steve Dahl. You've been voted in, Steve.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I want to also give some historical perspective here and then make some comments on the bill. I would say this up front, though. This is not Ohio, Florida, Utah, New Jersey, New York, or Minnesota. It's Oregon. And we have a little bit different system here. It's interesting to note that many of those states remand down to a far lower age, in some cases 12 and 13. And we don't do that in Oregon. And they also remand for a much broader net of crimes. From 1987 through 1993, Oregon's juvenile violent crime rate rose 67%. During that same time period, the overall juvenile crime rate rose by nearly 100%. Not only did the number of violent crimes increase dramatically, but so did their severity in the form of aggravated assaults, armed robberies, forcible rapes, and murders. A number of high-profile cases involving extremely violent juveniles brought the issue of juvenile remand to the attention of the legislature. Among them were the killings of Scott Bell and Jeffrey Walters. Scott Bell was taken into the hills of Clackamas County. He was bound by duct tape, shot execution style in the back of the head. The judge refused to remand the 17-year-old killer. He was sent to McLaren, where he bragged that he wanted to be a mobster and always wanted to murder someone execution style. He said he got away with it. He fooled everyone, especially, and this is his words, not mine, quote, unquote, even the stupid judge. The killer was set free 4 years later as soon as he turned 21. Jeffrey Walters was stabbed to death by Ryan Pingo in 1990 in Multnomah County. The judge refused to remand the 17-year-old killer. He, too, was set free 4 years later as soon as he turned 21. In 1993, the Oregon legislature considered House Bill 2994, which covered first-degree violent crimes. It passed in the House on a 51-7 vote and went to the Senate. Indications were that the vote was on the floor to pass it, but the House bill died in committee upon adjournment in August. Less than 1 month later, from when the bill died, 22-year-old Tim Hawley nearly died when he was savagely attacked in Lloyd Center's mall by three juveniles. Tim and his fiancée were leaving a movie theater. He was tackled, beaten, and thrown down a flight of stairs until unconscious. In order to save his life, doctors had to remove the front lobe of Hawley's brain. To this day, Hawley is severely disabled. The primary participants both had substantial juvenile court records. One was on probation for raping a 4-year-old girl. The other perpetrator had previously been referred to the juvenile authorities for participating in a similar beating. Nonetheless, a juvenile court judge again refused to waive either youth to adult court for trial. Both were set free as soon as they turned 21. The law at that time required that a violent juvenile criminal receive a remand hearing before a juvenile court judge who decided if the accused should be tried in a juvenile or adult court. This represented a mini-trial that traumatized victims that had to go through in which the subjective criteria determined the outcome. Violent juvenile criminals who were convicted in juvenile court were sent to juvenile detention where they could be released at any time by authorities. Victims never knew when these violent criminals would be released, and under no circumstances could these violent criminals be held beyond their 21st birthday. Once they were released, there was no post-prison supervision, and their criminal record was not available to the public. This was the state of juvenile justice when Measure 11 was placed on the ballot in November of 1994. And I think you have in your hands the actual text from the voter's guide on that, and you can see that there's no question that this was meant for those 15 and above, and on page 3 it lists the crimes and the previous sentences as they were at that time. Among the voter pamphlet arguments at that time was one that said if a 15-year-old robs a classmate of a hat, the mandatory sentence would be 7.5 years in prison. 12.5 years later, we are still waiting for the first 15-year-old hat robber to be sentenced under Measure 11. Measure 11 was passed by 2/3 majority of Oregon voters in November of 1994. In 2000, voters were once again asked to pass judgment on Measure 11 when Measure 94 was placed on the ballot. That ballot measure was defeated by nearly a 3-to-1 margin. From 95 to 2002, arrests of juveniles for violent crimes dropped 38%. Despite well-documented misrepresentations of Measure 11 opponents, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds convicted of Measure 11 crimes are not sent to adult prison. Every one of them is placed in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, where they live in dormitories, attend school, receive counseling and treatment, are taught self-discipline, and participate in sports. In most cases, the school attendance, counseling, treatment, etc. would not be happening except for Measure 11. Because most of the Measure 11 sentences are 8 years or less, all juveniles convicted of Measure 11 crimes can serve their entire sentence at the Oregon Youth Authority except if convicted of murder or multiple consecutive sentences. There are only three ways for juveniles to be sent to adult prison. First, if they commit a serious violent crime against staff or peers. Second, if they refuse to attend school and engage in treatment. At that time, they're given intensive counseling and usually takes 4 to 6 months for them to transfer to prison if they continue to refuse education and treatment. And third, if they reach 18 and persistently request to be transferred again, they're counseled, and at that point, if they still want to be transferred, they are. The number currently of juveniles in adult prison in Oregon is zero. Since the passage of Measure 11, the legislature, at the request of Crime Victims United and law enforcement, has modified the measure twice. In 1997, Senate Bill 1049 created exceptions for Assault 2, Robbery 2, and Kidnap 2. Under these exceptions, a judge has the discretion to depart below the Measure 11 sentence as far down as probation in cases where the criminal had no prior serious felony convictions, a deadly weapon was not used, and the victim did not suffer significant injury. These exceptions have been frequently used. In fact, the RAND Corporation report on Measure 11 analyzed the data from 1999, and they reported that 1049 exceptions was used in 27% of robbery 2s, 36% of assault 2s, and 40% of kidnap 2s. The report did not do a breakdown between adult and juvenile. However, it is certain that the exception rate for juveniles are much higher. In 2001, the legislature, again, at the request of Crime Victims United, created exceptions for all second-degree sex offenses and sex abuse ones where the perpetrator had no prior serious felony or sex offense convictions and was within 5 years of the age of the victim. That House bill, like 1049, gives the discretion to the judge to make the findings necessary to depart below Measure 11 to include probation. Finally, 45 states have various laws regarding waiving juveniles to adult court. 19 of these states have mandatory waiver based on the age of the defendant and or the crime. Some states have mandatory waiver for property crimes. Some states waive juveniles as young as 12 years old. Idaho, our next-door neighbor, has mandatory waiver down to the age of 14. Oregon is neither the most liberal state nor the most conservative state when it comes to waiving juveniles to adult court. Looking at the crimes for which we have mandatory waiver and the ages to which it applies, it is clear that our state has found the correct balance. Senate Bill 1014 would take us back to the days I discussed at the beginning of my testimony, where a juvenile who commits aggravated murder could spend 3, 4, 5, and in no case more than 10 years in custody, where juveniles who commit rape and armed robbery could be placed on probation. The word would soon be on the street among juveniles that there is no accountability in the system if they decide to commit a serious violent crime. This most likely would lead to increased violent juvenile crime and more victims. You might think these scenarios could never happen. However, they not only could happen, they have happened, and under Senate Bill 1014, they will happen again. Senate Bill 1014 would be harmful to victims, law-abiding citizens, and even to juvenile violent offenders. It is an affront to the voters who have twice given Measure 11 an overwhelming vote of confidence. It's bad policy, and it should be rejected. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Yes, I have one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Dole, you recently supplied my office with a memo dated April 9, 2007. Where you were concerned about my questions regarding prison construction. Quote, I was surprised to hear the question, cannot let it pass without answering. I've just finished reviewing that as you were speaking, and you have all these footnotes, and on the back you list all these footnotes, but I have no attachments. I'd very much like to see all of these attachments that you reference in your footnotes so that I can analyze the data that you extracted from them.
So, Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, let me... So you, in other words, you want us to take each footnote and print it out for you? Is that what you're basically saying?
That's exactly what I'd like.
Oh, okay. Sure. We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, because it is relevant to what your testimony was just now.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Harkleroad.
Oh, thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name's Doug Harkleroad. I'm the Lane County District Attorney for over 20 years. I've been in the business about 32 years and representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association today and opposing Senate Bill 1014. I will be brief. There are three reasons that I have identified why this bill should not be passed. The first one is it's unnecessary. I'll come back to that. The second one is this has been decided by our voters twice. And the third one is this is a very expensive bill, and I don't know where you're going to find the money. Okay, the first one, this is unnecessary. You need to understand, I suspect that, that most of you, if not all of you, do, that there is a whole group of juveniles that go into the juvenile justice system. The slice that we're talking about here is very small. it is the most violent of all of those juveniles. So the juvenile court is really dealing with everybody except those Measure 11 offenders. But then, what's really happening out in the real world, and I haven't heard any comments about that, I think I know what's happening, is that district attorneys are doing what they're supposed to do, and they're exercising their discretion to put people in or out of Measure 11. And so, Lane County, which I know the best, I asked our juvenile folks to give me statistics. Of the arrests in Lane County for ballot Measure 11, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, 17% are charged as adults. The remainder, 83%, stay in the juvenile system, and we figure out how to do that. Why? Because our juvenile intake center and our lawyer assigned to the juvenile department make intelligent decisions about what should happen, and this is not behind closed doors. To give you a different county, because I happen to know the information most recently from Columbia County, Steve Atchison is the district attorney there. He keeps track and has kept track of the last 20 cases that came in as arrests for ballot Measure 11. 25% of those went to adult court. 15 out of the 20, or 75%, stayed in the juvenile justice system. They're making good decisions, and I think while Bigelow will talk more about that for Marion County. So we're screening now, making intelligent decisions. And by the way, that's what district attorneys are supposed to do. I think you give us that power under the law, not just in ballot Measure 11, but we're the only, there's 36 people in the state of Oregon who can try to kill somebody legally, state-sponsored killing. We call that the death penalty. We make those decisions. And so this one doesn't seem nearly as important, although very important. Jessica's Law, you passed that last special session, I remember. That's a 25-year sentence on a serious sex offender. We will make a discretionary decision about what should happen, one case at a time, individually. This is not mass processing in an adult court, frankly, although we are, and I'd suggest our judges are overburdened there. Okay. So this thing is unnecessary, and I've commented on why that is. Okay. The society's decided this twice, in 95, again in 2000, by a vote of the people, that ballot Measure 11 is a measure that they wanted. And Steve Dole has commented on that. I need to say no more about that. Expensive. This is expensive. This bill says the criminal court having jurisdiction shall hold a hearing in each one of these cases. And then there's a whole series of criteria that counsel for the committee described. We're going to have a trial to decide whether or not we should remand. I predict hundreds of these, because every defense attorney, if they don't file that motion and they don't move in that direction to have that hearing, they're going to commit malpractice, or they're going to be worried about that, and they're going to worry about getting sued. So we're going to have that hearing. Now, it's not enough just to set a hearing. They need to be prepared. So they need a background on their individual that's being charged. So they're going to need an investigator, and if the kid happened to grow up in Missouri, somebody needs to go to Missouri. For the most part, it'll be local, because 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, they're local. Those will be expensive. They will take court time, and then the prosecution will, of course, have to respond. So it'll be expensive for the counties, because the state doesn't really support the prosecution function anymore. So somehow we'll have to figure out how to do that. It's expensive to do this. And then you talk about transcripts. I heard that mentioned in the previous testimony. Those transcripts are expensive to do every time. $4 a page, is it now? I happen to know that one of your members knows lots about this.
It's not the $4. I get $3.30 a page.
Oh, okay, $3.30 a page. That's fine. Yeah. So those, all those costs will mount up. And for what? I'd suggest to you that the decisions will be very similar to the decisions that the prosecutors are already making. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Both of you have mentioned the ballot measure 11 and the repeal effort. In my humble view, it just as a voter, that repeal effort was so flawed that even people who didn't like ballot measure 11 couldn't go along with that. So I think you have a good basis when you talk about, and it was more than two-thirds, it was more like 72% that supported ballot measure 11 at the get-go. But I think to put a lot of credence on just a terribly flawed repeal measure, for one thing, it was retroactive. It would have just released a bunch of people out of prison just from the get-go. I considered that a terrible flaw in it. So I just would like to see a little more sensitivity to the difference between those two elections.
Noted. Use my other two arguments.
Okay. Well, your expense one, you're talking to a tight wad here.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Begloff.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name's Walt Begloff. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I join my colleague here today, Crime Victims United, and the association in its opposition to Senate Bill 1014. My starting point is that don't change that which has been employed very effectively and most notably very fairly across the state and within district attorney's offices. I tend to see this as a bill that would undermine the value we put on accountability for 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and 17-year-olds, the effectiveness of the Oregon Youth Authority and its ability to look at a rehabilitative approach to things, and for victims, most notably, for victims in these cases. District Attorney Harkerwald spoke of the process or the discretion that is done within DA's offices, and I from 1993 to 2004 managed a child abuse team, an adult sexual assault team, and probably reviewed hundreds personally of Measure 11 cases after April of 1995. And the process there is to stop, look, evaluate, collaborate, look at the nature and circumstances, the age of the defendant, the age of the victims, the number of the victims, get an assessment, bring all of those tools that we are expected to have in making those choices and go in the right direction with that. So my team at that point would do that. We'd work with our juvenile deputies to assess that and make that decision. And there were many times where we chose this is not the right circumstance, using that entitled discretion and a good sense to send that back to our juvenile to do the appropriate thing. So that's the process, I'm confident, statewide that is used by district attorneys in making these decisions, that equity. The second equity point for me really pushes from a particular case that happened in Marion County, and just speaking about it brings chills to me. And I hope I don't disrespect the families of the victim in this case, because I have not talked about this case right now. And it really goes to that equitable approach. Many of these offenses, many of them are violent, as you know, involve more than one individual. And we had a family where three defendants burglarized a home in rural Oregon near Donald, stole some guns and would pass this house on the way, and those people would see that and they knew something was wrong. And those three individuals were 14, 16, and 19. They taunted that family. They returned to that home in a blaze of a gun battle in front of children and grandmother, murdered two of those families. The key player in that case was the 14-year-old, and the 16-year-old joined him in the house in the murder of this family. The equity. Can you imagine the decisions I had to make as district attorney as we move forward in holding them accountable, bringing justice and doing the right thing? The bottom line is those three deserved prison for as long as we could give, and that's what my community wanted. The 14-year-old agreed to be waived, but I tell you, I was sweating every day about that decision. The 15-year-old went to prison and the 19-year-old went to prison, who was the one who was waiting in the car for them. These are the kinds of decisions in front of us. These are the kinds of 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and 17-year-olds that we're now dealing with in our community. We had a case in Marion County that was an absolute failure prior to Measure 11. I went out on the case myself. I think it was in 1994. A young man brutally murdered his mother, stabbed her multiple times, many of which were in her pubic region. I was there at the autopsy. I still can't get that out of my mind. This was prior to Measure 11. He didn't get waived to adult court. He went to the youth authority and was out, and has been recently engaged in criminal conduct alleged by the county up north in future behavior. He should have gone to prison. These are the stories that are really driving what we're up against. This morning I met with all of my chiefs in Marion County. We talked about gangs, and what they said is we are seeing increasing sophistication from our young people. They're coming out of middle school ready to go, to be violent and be brought into their gangs. By the time they're a freshman, those focused in the gang activity are ready to commit violent offenses. We need to be prepared as communities to deal with that. And that's what we're really up against. Having looked at those cases over the years for sex offenders, many of these cases are sex offenders. I remember prior to Measure 11 that the adult sex offenders I had when we did an evaluation had numerous instances of sex offenses, what we would consider Measure 11 against children, all the way along. And I just remember wishing, how did we blow it? Why did there have to be more victims in those cases?
Can you wrap it up now? Because we're.
I'd be glad to. I just think that when we look at this, some deserve the prison, some deserve the equities that you get out of an Oregon Youth Authority, and that's where most of them are going. And finally, as far as public opinion is concerned, my community demands that I do this. And so I think that's the expectation, and they have embraced that, and I really do appreciate allowing you to share some of those stories that we're seeing here in Marion County. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, I need to correct the record. Mr. Dole, the memo came from your policy analyst and director, Howard Rodstein, not you personally, but from your organization.
Madam Chair. Just a clarification. One of your last statements, you said that's where, when you said these offenders need to go to prison or adult prison, that's where many of them go. But yet, don't all 15, 16, 17 year olds go to juvenile until they get to age 25?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, correct. They all go to the Department of Corrections, but they go to the Oregon Youth Authority until they are 25. Most of the Measure 11 sentences are 90 months or less, and we craft sentences that allow them to do all of their time in the rehabilitative model of the Oregon Youth Authority. The ones that don't are murder, manslaughter, and as Mr. Dole mentioned, those consecutive sentences, which at that point are obviously you want someone to be launched in for as long as they can in a prison setting so they don't harm anyone else.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I gave the first two panels a latitude, as I usually do, so we can get all the arguments out there. But from here on out, I'd like people to really focus on keeping your comments brief so that we can get everybody in. So our next panel is Dr. Alex Stevens, Sheila Montgomery, and Georgia Lawrence. Welcome. We'll start with Dr. Stevens.
Madam Chair, Committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today regarding Bill SB 1014. My name's Alexander Stevens. I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at Oregon Health and Science University. I am primarily a researcher, and the focus of my research is on brain development and the use of magnetic resonance imaging technologies for looking at brain structure and function. Just as some background from where I'm coming from. I'm here on my own account, but the views I'm expressing, I would say, are the views of the scientific community regarding adolescent brain development. There's really three issues I want to address today. And those are the adolescent's abilities regarding decision-making and judgment, adolescent brain development, and the relationship between these two and the types of behaviors we see in adolescents. I've provided you with a handout because some of my comments, I think, are more easily understood by some graphics. I work in the imaging world, and many of the things we do is take pictures. The first figure in front of you is a chart of the causes of mortality in individuals 10 to 24 years of age. And about 70% of those are due to motor vehicle accidents, other unintentional injuries such as jumping off bridges without seeing how deep the water is, homicides and suicides. These four categories account for, as I say, over 70% of the deaths in juveniles. Something that's common to all of them is they are usually the result of faulty decision making. These are the extremes, but as all of us were once adolescents, and many of us have adolescent children, we're aware of the lapses in critical thinking and decision making that adolescents are prone to. How often have we heard one parent say to an adolescent, "What were you thinking?" And the response being, "I don't know." There's a reason for this, and that is that adolescents possess an immature brain. Brain development now, as we understand it, the brain does not reach full development until the mid-20s. Research in the last 5 to 10 years has demonstrated that the front of the brain, particularly the frontal lobe, is the last to develop. This is the area that's critical for decision-making, assessing situations, and the integration of cognitive and emotional information. The reason I present this information is because this area of the brain, the frontal lobes, is the most susceptible to disruption by things like stress. It's the area that we're critically dependent on for making social evaluations. And it's, as I say, susceptible to stress, peer pressure, and as a result, can lead to very faulty decisions that have very, very dire consequences. The process of brain development depends on two things. One is the reduction of gray matter, the neurons in the brain. The second is the development of white matter. White matter is myelin, and myelin is basically the insulation that wraps around neurons, allowing them to communicate effectively. If you look at the bottom left figure of the colored brain, there's areas of the brain that are shown in dark blue to purple. Those are areas of the brain that reflect complete maturity, the adult developed brain. Areas in the green and the yellow and reds are areas that have not yet reached full development. From the left, there's a timeline going from age 5 to age 20. And if you notice, the brain generally becomes darker as time goes by. But nonetheless, even at age 20, there are areas in the front of the brain, in the frontal lobe, that still have not reached full development. That's at age 20. There have now been dozens of studies with thousands of children over the developmental trajectory of very young to middle to late 20s that show the same thing, that this area of the brain is still developing. The relevance to the bill before you today is that adolescents vary, individuals vary, and the level of development that any individual has reached at any particular time varies. Some individuals will come before you or come before a judge who have committed heinous crimes, murder, attempted murder, aggravated assault, and they will have committed these things typically in the presence of peers. That's one of the things we know is very different between adolescents and adults. Adolescents commit crimes with one or more peers. Adults do not. And it's these peer influences that have a dramatic effect on the way adolescents behave. So I'll wrap up simply by saying that it's very important when a juvenile comes before a court that their developmental state be taken into account, and that their ability to understand, not necessarily to accept the culpability that may be due them, but really their ability to understand their actions at the time of their act. And that is something that's very, very different between an adolescent and an adult. It's also different within the context in which the crime takes place. If you sit an adolescent down in a living room and ask them whether it's right or wrong to drink and drive, you can be pretty sure they'll tell you what you want to hear. But that doesn't stop them from doing it. And that doesn't mean they didn't mean not to do it. So goes for some of the crimes they commit. These are crimes that were committed in moments that may reflect a very, very poor lapse in judgment. And those sorts of considerations have to be taken into account so we're not treating an adolescent or a juvenile with an adolescent or juvenile brain like an adult with an adult brain. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And for Ms. Lawrence and Ms. Montgomery, we have copies of your written statement, so if you could just summarize those.
Thank you for allowing me to be here, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm here to support...
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Sheila Montgomery. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1014. Again, my name is Sheila Montgomery, and I'm a mother of three teenage boys and a five-year-old daughter. And I'd like to just share our brief story about our harsh awakening to how Oregon treats some youth in the criminal justice system. My son was 15 years old and had recently been diagnosed bipolar, and there was numerous deaths in our family, and he was having a hard time coming to terms with that. Without me knowing that he went off of his medicine, he had ran away, and while he ran away, he got involved, went and stayed with a guy that was a bad influence, and the guy he stayed with wanted to go rob a convenience store. My son went with him and sat in the guy's car while the store was robbed. Thank God nobody was hurt. My son was automatically remanded to the adult court system. He was charged with robbery 1 and robbery 2, aiding and abetting, which are both Measure 11 crimes, and sentenced with the mandatory minimum. He, at that time, was sentenced to 7.5 years. This was Zach's first offense. He had never had a criminal record before this. He had never spent any time in the jail. Yet, he still received 90 months. So, at 15 years old, he started serving a very adult sentence as a child. The ripple effects of this have affected everybody in our family. Even my little girl doesn't understand why her brother can't come home with her when we go see him. Thankfully, my son's story went into the paper about 2 years after he had been in custody, and the DA's office recently decided to cut him a deal. So my son will be home this year after serving nearly 3 years on this charge. And again, it was his first offense. My reason for being here is some kids won't have somebody there that will be in support of seeing justice served. He did do something. He deserved a consequence, but 90 months was the wrong approach. It could have been handled in the juvenile justice system and could have been handled more effectively, getting the proper counseling and treatment and being in their facility rather than an adult sentence. And I just thank you guys, and I hope that you strongly will support Senate Bill 1014.
Thank you very much.
And I'm Georgia Lawrence. I also come here today to support Senate Bill 1014. It's very difficult for me to share certain aspects of my personal life in such a public environment, but I am compelled to do so given what's at stake. it's relevant to begin by letting you know I'm a survivor of childhood rape and other extreme physical violence. I did benefit from intervention. A school counselor noticed troubles, and I became a ward of the court. However, a foster home placement offered no solace and more harm. For my safety, I ran away. And when I ran away, people considered me as at risk, and I was unquestionably at risk of a number of things, more violence, homelessness. Turning to a life of crime, not getting an education, or a chance to change the hurt from the past. So the wounds from the crime that I endure linger 20 years later. I'm 34 years old. Through struggle and perseverance, I managed to get my GED in my 20s. I went and earned a scholarship at Lewis and Clark College here in Oregon and graduated second in my class. I even was fellowshipped at Stanford University and earned my graduate degree. But much more importantly, I went on to educate children in circumstances familiar to my own. I worked with teenagers who had been adjudicated. And I'm here to tell you that we need to give young people a more thoughtful process before treating them as adults in the criminal justice system. I know from firsthand experience from my own life and from many of my students that young people can and do transform. And we need to remember that adolescence is a very challenging age, and there's a difference between youth and adults. We need to have different standards for establishing culpability and accountability. How can we assure that young Oregonians, not unlike myself, in tough circumstances, can transform into positive members of our community and not at the expense of long-term inmates? Senate Bill 1014 is something that creates a process that asks the right questions before the state decides to treat juveniles as adults. And this is too serious a decision to make without more careful consideration. I recognize that at oftentimes the state takes a punitive approach, somehow in the name of crime victims. I choose to not think of myself as a victim, rather as a survivor of many of the scary acts that catch people's attention and that we've heard of today. And from that perspective, I know that there's anger, there's fear, and even vengeance that's part of an emotional response to harm. I know this. But just like youth who can make terrible mistakes and they transform into people who wouldn't do it again, and it's possible that survivors also do change. I know that I have changed. My own sense of justice and accountability has changed through time and experience. And what I seek has changed now. With Senate Bill 1014, there's a chance to see a different process that recognizes my hope for that change. So in recognizing this possibility, we understand often that youth in the system are survivors and offenders, and that they're not mutually exclusive identities oftentimes. And sadly, the violence that many youth experience is a major contributing factor to why they have challenges and why criminal behavior takes place. And this is the important reason why we must be careful in the sentencing process of young people. Senate Bill 1014 ensures that we don't let young people slip through the cracks. I've been that young person whose life was almost thrown away. I've seen incredible potential and beauty of young people who people write off as scary or broken. And one of the reasons I got into education is that I care deeply about protecting the future of youth on the edge of society who are easily stereotyped. They're ignored, locked up, and then tragically forgotten. Oregon's kids deserve better. I hope you decide to support Senate Bill 1014.
Thank you for coming, and congratulations on all you've done with your life. It's amazing.
Questions? Yeah, I do. Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. I really appreciate your testimony. The words I wrote down on my notepad, one of your last few paragraphs, were society's misfits. People are quick to label these children who commit these crimes as society's misfits when Ms. Montgomery...
I didn't use the words misfits?
No, so no, sure. I okay. used it.
Oh, okay.
I wrote that. That was my interpretation. And Ms. Montgomery illustrated that with her own son. You know, here he had a medical problem and went off his medication and committed a crime, and then he was treated as if he was a misfit or a criminal, a serious, serious criminal, and actually his criminality was brought on by a different set of circumstances. Let me ask Dr. Stevens one question, and then I'll be done. I found your testimony extremely fascinating. It's sort of what I've been focusing on about these are children, even though people don't want to believe that they are children. How could a child commit a crime such as D.A. Walt Begla was talking about? But he said something that really disturbed me. He said these kids are coming out of middle school ready to engage in violent crime. And he was so worked up about it, I was beginning to be fearful of all these children in middle school. And that's not right. So I really appreciated your perspective that the brain is not yet developed, and some of these children, they just get synapses along the way that don't quite hit it. What are you thinking? So, you know, how does that work with the juvenile system? What can we do about interfacing that viewpoint with crime in Oregon? It's a big question.
It is a big question, and I'm not sure I have a good answer for you. But one thing I can say is that with any individual, there are a number of factors that play into ultimately who they become. One of those is developmental. And the issue here is when we see a defendant or a juvenile who comes before the court, the question is, what is the motivation of their action? What led to their action? Is it their developmental stage, or may there be some underlying pathology that isn't something we know how to treat and handle in society? So those are distinctions that absolutely need to be made. We don't want someone who's going to be a repeat offender where there is very little we can do. We know the difference between a sociopath and simply an immature child. But we need to be able to evaluate these kids, especially when they are the misfit or don't look like they belong. Because we do rush to judgment sometimes based on how someone looks. And what we need to do is consider what this individual in front of us has going for them, where they are in their development, and what the potential is for rehabilitation. I mean, I think those are really the factors that we have to consider. And the problem when we put someone into a system that, I mean, if we're talking about middle school kids who are coming out ready to kill, we have to look at that environment. And whether that environment's in the school or in prison, we have to do something to address it. But we have to do something that allows us to intervene on that child's behalf.
Okay. Yeah, I know. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to ask that question, because I believe it deserved an answer, and we got a very good one. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Our next panel will be Kevin Mannix and Ken Chapman. It's just so long time to get people in with this one. Is Kevin Mannix in here?
He's
so, Mark, why don't you come up then and testify? I'm just trying to be fair. Some of you didn't get a chance to testify this morning, so I'm trying to jigger around a little bit. Welcome.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Ken Chapman. I'm here because for 35 years I was in the juvenile system as a probation officer and the supervisor of probation officers. And I, too, am a very strong supporter of of the juvenile system. But I speak in opposition to this bill. And I think it's important to put some perspective to the numbers when we're dealing with Measure 11 and juveniles. According to the reports, the JGIS reports and the OYA website, there's something over 26,000 criminal referrals by juveniles each year. Approximately 2,500 of them represent serious person crimes. We have only 57, an average of 57 juveniles each year going to through being sentenced on Measure 11. That is a very small amount, and they represent only 7% of the total of those serving time on Measure 11. So let me put it actually in a more positive way. Senator Walker, you mentioned that you thought that juveniles should be dealt with individually and have the benefits of the juvenile system. And I agree with you almost completely. In fact, I agree with you 998 times out of 1,000. Because what we're dealing with are two cases out of 1,000 that are so violent that they need to be sent directly to adult court. I don't think that's unreasonable. I don't think it undermines the juvenile court. And I think there are some cases where the needs for the victim to be certain are so strong that they outweigh the best interest of the offender. Senate Bill 1 made that clear. Senate Bill 1 said that reformation is one of the objects of the juvenile system, except, or it said, within the context of public safety. Looking back on 12 years of Measure 11, I actually think the state should be proud that the law which governs our most serious offenders is so tightly focused, and the DAs have used such obvious discretion that we have only two cases in 1,000 going through Measure 11. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, and thank you for keeping it brief. Welcome, Mr. McDonald.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I've delivered today to the committee a letter from Mr. Shunk in opposition to Senate Bill 1014.
And we will make Mr. Shunk's letter a matter of the record.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I headed our juvenile unit from 1990 to 95 when juvenile crime in Oregon was out of control. I handled many of the remand hearings that have been mentioned here today. In fact, dozens of cases involving murder, attempted murder, aggravated assault, and rape. Many of these offenders had serious prior records. And despite that fact, in several of these cases, even though these individuals posed a clear danger to the community, they were not remanded to juvenile court for criminal prosecution. A couple things to keep in mind about these hearings. One is that they often were multiple-day events. In fact, in Mr. Dole's case, in which they were successful in the remand, the hearing went on for 2 weeks. And psychologists and psychiatrists from both sides testified at great public expense. And one of the things I found in doing these types of hearings is that you really can find an expert or a psychologist to support any position. It's not necessarily that they're a hired gun, but you know, there's people out there that will say essentially anything or support any position. And the state pays for that. The other problem with remand hearings in Senate Bill 1014 is that it shifts the focus away from the seriousness of the crime and the impact on the victim and public safety to what's the best interest of the offender. I understand why many people want to concentrate on that. It really loses the focus of what this person has done. And I have dealt with a lot of victims in these cases and victims' families, and they simply cannot understand why there would be any question after what they or their loved ones have suffered, whether or not this person should be prosecuted in juvenile adult court. They simply cannot understand that. And especially in those cases where the waiver did not occur, it really posed a serious block to their recovery, to getting on with their lives, that they were focused on the fact that justice was not done in their particular case. And they couldn't get by that. A couple of other comments, other than the system has been very successful. Both adult and juvenile crime rate has gone down dramatically in Oregon, about 45% since the passage of Measure 11, the third highest rate of any state in the country, while our property crime rate has still remained very high.
Ms. McDonald, can I break in for just a second? We have a lot of this information
right.
in the letter that you submitted, and we're out of time. There's a couple people that weren't able to testify this morning that I'd like to be able to get in. So if you could wrap it up.
Sure, I will. Just a couple comments. One, the juvenile system has removed a lot of the bad apples who in the past drew other juveniles who were not leading towards criminal behavior. It removed those people out of the system, so they're not affecting other youth. Two, it has allowed the juvenile system to concentrate on the less serious offenders, and I think they've been doing a really good job. And then lastly, if there's only two things I've learned in my 27 years as a prosecutor, is one is that the best predictor of future violence-ness or future danger is past behavior. And two, the most important factor in recidivism is age, that at age 24 or 25, the rate of recidivism drops dramatically. So what Measure 11 does is it takes the most serious offenders and locks them up at a period where they're most likely to reoffend.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing the letter from Mr. Schrunk. Any questions from the committee? And thank you for keeping it brief, both of you. Okay, we're going to take two more people on each side, and then we're going to be over our time, and I'm going to lose members of my committee, so the briefer you can keep it, the better. Tom English and Roger Martin.
Thank you. I'll begin. And I'll also be brief. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Tom English. I'm an ordained Episcopal minister at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Eugene, Oregon, where I also serve as a chaplain at the Lane County Jail. I also work with the Oregon Department of Corrections in helping prisoners return back to Lane County. I have a master's degree in corrections. And I've served as consultant to the United States Department of Justice, Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention for more than 20 years. I served on the original Felony Sentencing Guidelines Commission, so I'm very familiar with that aspect of it. But I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 1014 because of it's a necessary way to take a look at transfer and reverse the kind of situations we've had in the past. And I have really just four reasons for that. More than 90% of everybody we convict comes back to the community they were convicted from. The question is, how do you want them coming back? It's something we need to take a look at in terms of public safety in our own community. Current research and best practices affirm that punishment, in this case, the length of time in incarceration, alone by itself does not deter virtue behavior nor change individual behavior. What does work are correctional interventions and policies that are based upon 8 principles of effective intervention. And I'm not going to go into all of those 8 to here, but there are 6 of them that apply. One is to the use of the scientific tools that assess risk and need. The other one is enhancing offenders' intrinsic motivation. Being locked up in a ballot measure 11 with no incentive flies in the face of that. And when in targeting interventions that embrace the risk and need and responsivity, those principles have to do with focusing the treatment on the highest risk offenders. They have to do with addressing the criminogenic needs of those offenders, and then making the appropriate response that fits those individuals. So it talks about individual justice. The fourth one is providing individual skill training and directed practice for offenders, and then increasing the positive reinforcement, and then most importantly, engaging and keeping engaged the community in which they came from. Finally, Senate Bill 1014 is the right thing to do. It really is. It's helping us to improve the lives of people in their community. It's, in spite of budget cutbacks and all of the problems we've had in Lane County and statewide, dedicated correctional professionals are working to implement these at the local level and at the state level, and we need to support that with correctional policies that make sense. And finally, I will just say this. Grief and guilt are, in the highest sense, pastoral issues. And probably one of the most detrimental things for people dealing with guilt and grief is retribution. And it's very natural whether somebody has died. When somebody's died in the parish and we deal with the family, they're angry with the doctor, they're angry with the hospital, they want to sue them. Anger is a very natural part of that. But they need to move beyond that to acceptance and to move beyond that to forgiveness. When we set up systems that block that and exploit victims, it becomes counterproductive and we end up with even more tragedy. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions?
Okay. Mr. Martin. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. We are supportive of Senate Bill 1014, or some version that you may change it to be, and I urge you to take a serious look at this. So let me just use a couple of terms that have been used earlier. Society has twice voted on this. I'm one of those that voted for Measure 11. I belong to a large group of let's get tough on the bad guy group of people. We have coffee every morning, and all of us voted for Measure 11. I think every one of us thinks now you need to take a second look at this. There was a term used several times, great public expense. Well, may I point out to you that as effective as ballot Measure 11 has been, and I have no doubt that it's reduced crime in Oregon, it is also a huge expense. The prison budget for this session of the legislature is $1.5 billion. Compare that to the one for higher education, which is under 700,000. We're going to spend, it's a little higher than that, but we're almost twice as much money on our prison system as we are on higher education. And I'm here to tell you that if you simply look at statistics, Measure 11 is going to eat your lunch as legislators trying to fund the state of Oregon. Just like ballot measure 5 did back in 1990, we're spending more and more money on our share of schools and taking it off somebody else's. It's the payroll that you have to pay. Measure 11 has increased, double the size of our state penitentiary system, and it will double again in 10 years. Now, we can choose to say it's good because we've cut the crime rate way down, or you can start to re-examine some of the edges of this. And I was forced to do that within the last several years. I have a godson who spent 3 years at McLaren. He was sentenced from Washington County. He had made two bad mistakes. Number one, he committed his crime in Washington County. I've been told by a dozen attorneys and judges, had he committed the same crime in Multnomah or Clackamas counties, he would have had some kind of probation, but not in Washington County. And I won't go into all the details. I read the police report, and had you read the police report and been a prosecutor, you would have thrown the book at him. It was classic. It was kind of one-sided, but it was classic. He used a knife in defending himself in a fight. He happened to be in a fight with a kid who was going to beat his brains out against a cement floor, but he
Mr.
made
Martin,
a mistake.
Mr. Martin, you got to wrap this up because we're running out of time.
I had the insight of going to McLaren a few dozen times over the last 3 years. And one thing you realize very quickly when you get inside McLaren and look around is, number one, 80% of the people that are there should be there. But there's another element that's there, and you say to yourself, what the hell are they doing here? And when you talk to them, you find out. At age 14, at 15 or 16, they were foolish, made a mistake, and now they're there. And these were all Measure 11, 90-month sentences, and most of them are just spending the rest of the time to get through that 90 months. I urge you to take a serious look at this. This is one aspect, and I think you ought to seriously take a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to have two more people who have to talk very fast. Rudolfo Guerrero and Mary Ellidge. Sorry if I ruined your names here. It was either not take you at all or give you like 2 minutes each. Thank you.
I will make this very quick. I will just get back to my summary. I'm Mary Ellidge, and I'm chapter leader of Parents of Murdered Children. Unfortunately, our group deals with nothing but the worst crime possible, the crime that no amount of time ever takes away. My son was brutally murdered by a young man and two other men that the one man who crushed his skull with a baseball bat, he was murdered in our home, had just been released from McLaren because he was tried as a juvenile, and at that time, 20 years ago, you were released at 18. Though he was sent to prison after that. By then he was 19 after he murdered our son. He was out just 1 year. And before they released him, they said he was capable of committing a murder. But I have met other families over the last 20 years that I have been working for Parents of Murdered Children, and that their loved ones were killed by dangerous juvenile offenders. In many cases, like mine, it was more painful to know that the early release of that offender was why their loved one was murdered. Because had he been kept the amount of time that he should be, that we are trying to do now with Measure 11, he would not have been out. Our criminal justice system needs to be accountable for the protection of society. You are dead if you are killed by a person 14, 15, or 16, or if you're killed by someone 50 years old. You're still dead. Youths who are dangerous need to be where they cannot harm others, even other juveniles. That are in prison with them, when they commit dangerous person-to-person crimes, they need to be where they will. They need to be sentenced in adult courts. I urge you not to support Senate Bill 1014 because Oregon does not need more victims. Being murdered, raped, kidnapped, or sexually abused is as permanent and painful no matter the age of the criminal who committed the crime. Our society needs to be protected. Our children also need to be protected from these other young, dangerous criminals. I thank you for listening.
Thank you, and thank you for keeping it brief. Okay, last witness.
Good afternoon.
Can you get
Madam
a little
Chair?
Closer to the mic?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rodolfo Gonzalez. On May 29, 2003, my daughter Sandra, 13 years old, was attacked for a 15 years old boy. He sodomized my daughter, put a knife in his throat, took her to the place when he wanted to rape her. Month after that happened, my daughter, can I go to school? Can I go by herself to the store? She was afraid of any young guy coming in the street or on the bus. How long is she going to be affected for this? How long? I don't know. It's really hard for her, for us. David Morris is the name of the boy who did this. Her mom came to my house. She wanted to see how my daughter is doing. It's a nice thing for her, but it wasn't a nice thing for my daughter to see the mother or the guy who attacked her. I had to be short, because I cannot talk. But I will ask you not to change this law, Measure 11. Keep it as a tool. A tool that is going to be used for the district attorney. They are doing the job, and they have the tools. And they will apply and use this tool when they need it. Because they will see each case as a single case, they will decide to use Measure 11 or not to use it, but no change.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And thank you both again for keeping it brief. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 1014. Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you, committee. Oh, boy.